Thank you all. My name is Jay, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm from the group of Into Action group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we meet every Tuesday night and every Thursday night on Forest Hill Avenue in Richmond, Virginia. There's a lot of faces here that are familiar to me, people that have come. Gary spoke, Bill, you spoke to our group, Sam has too. And I look at being asked to come and speak to an Alcoholics Anonymous group to be the supreme compliment. When I first came into our home group back in 2009, Sam was always coming to our meeting, and I remember asking my sponsor, "Tell me a little bit about Sam." He kept saying, "Sam's an old timer. Sam's an old timer." Well, you know, Sam's got my vote, because anybody that has that long term of sobriety, manage a liquor store, and most of all would ride 2 hours on a motorcycle to come to an AA meeting. I mean, I had a lot of respect for it, so it's good knowing you, Sam, and thanks a whole lot for asking me to come up here. The last time I picked up a drink, or the last time I hope I picked up my last drink, was June 1st, 2009. Like I said, I've got a home group. We meet every Tuesday night and every Thursday night at 7 o'clock in Bethany Christian Church in Richmond, Virginia. So, you know, ride down there sometime with Sam and these other guys. We'd love to have you. I've got a sponsor. I'm here to say, if you don't have a sponsor, get one. It has been the difference between life and death, as far as I'm concerned. I'll sponsor two other people. Again, probably what I look as probably one of the pinnacles of AA service, and has really changed the direction of my sobriety, working with these people and watching these people grow as I did and other people do through sobriety. My story that I'm going to share, I'm going to tell you, it's not a horror story. I never lost a paycheck, didn't lose a home, didn't lose life, property, family, almost did. What my story is one of the slow, insidious progression that alcoholism is, and it over many, many years, a story of some relapse, a story of false promises, but I hope that somebody in here can relate to that. I came from a very good family. I'm supposed to say what it was like. I came from a very good family. I don't remember alcoholism in my family. Alcohol was always there. It was always there. It was always accepted. If there was a social function, it was always present. I can remember people having a good time and laughing and giggling, but I don't remember drunks around. I don't remember a whole lot of people in my immediate family having a problem with it. I remember my father would always come home from work, and he would have what he would call a shooter. He would take a shot glass and a Pepsi Cola. He used to drink bourbon called Century Club. He used to call it Cemetery Club. So he would drink it, and it would be one shot, and that would be it. You know, there would never be anything else. You know, little gatherings that we had in the neighborhood. He had his best friend and everything. There was always alcohol around, but I don't ever remember anybody getting out of the way. I remember one time when I was like 6 or 7 years old, my Aunt Beale walked up the street, and she had to walk. She probably had a fight with my uncle, and she walked up the street. I can remember I was playing out in the yard, and I can remember this look on her face. I ran into the house and I said, "Mom, I think Aunt Beale's walking up the street. I think something's wrong." My mother knew what was wrong. She went out there and got that situation straight. I had an Uncle Doyle, and Uncle Doyle was an alcoholic. I mean, my parents would use that term, but he wasn't on my side of the family. There was no direct bloodline there. I remember having to be pushed through the window one time, the bathroom window, because poor old Uncle Doyle had locked himself, gotten drunk, locked himself in the bathroom. I can remember talking to my mom. My mom's name was Maggie. She said, "Maggie, I love you, but I can't figure out how to get out of this bathroom." I had to go in there and say, push me through the window. I had to figure out how to get him out of the bathroom. About 3 years later, I remember he was down visiting us again, and he was making coffee. I said, "Uncle Doyle, you make the best coffee." And he goes, "That's what they tell me in my AA group." You know, and from that point on and forward, he stayed with AA up to the point that he passed away, bless his heart. But a few years later, when my mom and dad had passed, we were going through all their effects and everything like that, pulled out a death certificate of a grandfather that I'd never seen before. And on that death certificate was cause of death, acute alcoholism. So somewhere buried, and this was like a long time ago, somewhere buried back in that place, that's where it was. So I think probably the first time that I ever had a drink was probably back in 1968. And I grew up down south of Richmond. I grew up down in Hopewell, kind of a regular old mill town, blue collar family. But my first drink I can remember, I was like in the ninth grade, myself and a friend of mine named Mike. We were camping out in the yard, and I remember it was all plant. I remember my next door neighbor was getting married. She was getting married, and she'd met a guy down in Florida, and his name was Tom. And like I said, there was always a lot of alcohol around. And we went up to him and said, Tom, if you would, if you don't mind, there's a lot of whiskey here. When it gets down to about a half a bottle, how about throwing it out for me and Mike?" And I can remember looking around the corner of that house. I remember that bottle of whiskey being thrown into the bushes. I mean, we were scrambling right there. And I didn't get intoxicated that night. I remember Mike did. Mike had a girlfriend, and he drank like most of that bottle. And he was sitting there going, the girlfriend's name was Peggy, and all I heard all night long was, "Jay, why don't Peggy like me?" Yeah, probably because you're drunk, Mike. But that was my first experience with the two kind of people I dislike the most: a drunk person when I'm sober, and a sober person when I'm drunk. But the first time I ever fired for effect was a little bit less than a year after that, and I was at a school function, and we were drinking Schlitz beer, and I just wanted to see what it was that all these older kids saw about this, you know, because it was the cool thing to do back at that time, you know. That was before drugs or anything like that, and I just wanted to see what it was that they were experiencing. And I got drunk that night off of Schlitz beer, and the next morning I remember waking up with a worse hangover, but there was something to it, you know. There was something to it that I liked, you know. And I would drink with my buddies, and this was back in the day where you could get 3-2 beer if you were 18 years old in Virginia. It was, you know, at that age, you know, everybody knew somebody that was 18 years old that could get you 3-2 beer. And I remember one time that my buddy of mine he got married he had just graduated from high school, and I was a senior in high school, or I was a junior in high school. I can't really remember that, but we went to his bachelor party, and my mother said, "You need to get something in your stomach if you're going to go out tonight." And she'd made this big old pot of potato soup. And I went to this party, and this bachelor party, and drank and drank and drank and drank. And again, the next morning I woke up with the worst hangover in the world, and a hair full of potatoes. And I remember my mother using words such as mortified. "I am mortified." I'll never forget her saying that. "I am mortified." I said, "Mom, I'm sick." She had no pity on me whatsoever. But the corner that this was turned, the turning point of this part of my drinking career was that the next day, or when I bumped into my buddies, they were telling me, "You know, you look like you were having such a great time. You were this, you were that, you were so funny." You know, it was like all of a sudden I had arrived. I had realized that alcohol gave me a new sensation. It gave me it greased the social skids. And that was the first time that I experienced this. You know, it made me feel, it had a power. It made me feel acceptable. It went to a new level. About my senior year in high school, I started growing my hair long, started hanging around with, you know, some different people, not totally different people, but at that particular time, I started to discover pot. And from that point on, my second semester of high school, all the way up until the time that I graduated from college, I smoked pot every day, every single day. But it was really something. It was really something to drink with. You know, it was another companion to drink with. I experimented with other drugs, but to be honest with you, I was able at the end of 4 years of college. I said enough is enough, and I was able to put it down, and that was it. I was never able to do that with alcohol. You know, it was a totally different animal as far as I was concerned. Went on to college, and when I went into college, I had set a goal for myself. When I go to college, I knew right then and there that I wanted to be a dentist. So I set my mind right then and there that I didn't have a backstop, came from a blue collar family, you know, and I wanted to be self-employed, and that was the only way I knew to do it. I had a relative in my family that was a dentist. And what I did when I went to college, it was I focused from 4 o'clock, I mean from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock every night. I studied. At 10 o'clock, we start smoking pot till midnight. On Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, we would get God's own drunk. I had gravitated to the same kind of people, hard drinking, hard partying, hard studying, long hairs, okay, that were like me at the time, you know. But I remember we were in college. I went to school down in North Carolina. Down there, we would have penny beer night. I'm not kidding you. We would go to this place called the Knight's Inn, and they had Dixie cups, and for 25 cents, you know, we would be staggering home. It started to be at this particular point that I started to make a series of bad decisions. But I never thought alcohol had anything to do with it, you know. And I came home. My routine is I'd come home for summer. My dad always had a job for me in one of the plants there that doesn't exist anymore, but he always had a summer job for me. I think it was at Honeywell. And I remember this was in 1973. Went to 4th of July, the fireworks out at Fort Lee, and we got plastered. I got plastered, and decided to drive over. There's a little girl I knew over in Richmond, and decided to ride over there to see her. Just plastered, I get looking for love in all the wrong places. And she wasn't there. Got mad. Drove on back home. Was coming down Jefferson Davis Highway, about 60 miles an hour. And I don't know if y'all know what Jefferson Davis Highway is. Route 1. I mean, it's pretty populated. And I remember seeing lights in my rearview mirror. You know, classic good cop, bad cop type of routine. Had long hair back in those days. And I remember one of the cops goes, "I think I smell marijuana in this car." And the other cop goes, "No, there's no marijuana. This guy's just a drunk." And they literally threw me in the paddy wagon. I mean, literally threw me in the paddy wagon. Took me downstairs. I was in downtown. I was in. There was no discrimination. They put me in a cell with murderers. I mean, the next day it was a mishmash in that paddy wagon riding down to be arraigned. But lost my license for a year. This was back in the days before ASAP. Lost my license for a year. Had to pay $200. But not once did anybody say, the judge or nobody say, "You may have a drinking problem." you know, where today, if this would have happened, they're going to run you through the ringer on that, and that's a good thing. I don't know if that would have made a difference for me or anything like that, but that's the way it was. I remember my dad and the attorney sitting there, and the police had asked me, "Do you have any kind of illnesses? Is there anything, you know, is there any kind of physical problem going on with you?" And I said, or any kind of mental disease going on with you? And I said, "Yeah, I'm crazy as I can be." And that came out in court, and I remember my father going just like that. I remember one time I went back to college again, and 12 o'clock at night, we'd been partying, 12 o'clock at night, and all the girls were over at East Carolina. I went to college in Wilson. 12 o'clock at night, I was drunk. Thought it'd be a good idea. I couldn't drive a car because the car was gone. So I thought it'd be a good idea to hitchhike. You know, going to East Carolina, it was a two-lane highway, kind of like the one going from here to Gordonsville. I got picked up by four strangers, okay? And by the grace, that was one of these kinds of things, just like this DUI. By the grace of God, you know, nothing bad happened. But, you know, again, bad judgment call. You know, the other bad judgment call was with women. You know, every time, I never had a date with a woman at a certain period where I can't remember being drunk. And I was always wondering why there was never another date. I remember one time this poor girl and she was real nice to me. She liked me a whole lot. She set up a blind date with me, and I didn't care much for the blind date. And I sat there with another friend of mine and got drunk as I could be. And I remember that girl never spoke to me, not the date, but the other girl that set it up, never spoke to me again. And I still feel shame about that. You know, the thing about it was is that I was, all through college, I was able to do all this and maintain an almost straight A average. You know, I was able to, my life was compartmentalized. You know, I didn't realize that part of my life was totally spinning out of control. I was saying to myself, if I can make this kind of grades, if I can make these grades and still party like the rest of these guys, I thought I had it licked. Then what's the big deal? You know, if I can do this and everything comes together, then what's the big deal? I got accepted at dental school, and same thing. I gravitated to the same kind of people in dental school that I did when I was in college. There were just more of them like me in dental school. You know, these guys that studied hard. And at MCV, my sponsor works at VCU. He says you got to call it VCU now. But at MCV at that time, at the end of every week, the school sponsored a keg party. You know, so here's 110 guys that went through class all week long. At the end of the week, you know, here's some kegs. We're going to float these kegs. We had don't get me wrong. I'm not blaming MCV for my alcoholism. But I can remember one time I was taking gross anatomy, and we had an anatomy lab, and it was a big test. You know, we'd finished the test, and this was when after we finished the test, we were in the big laboratory. The lab was just like this, and cadavers everywhere. The professors had a grain party for us, you know. So it was just absolutely bizarre. But, you know, again, it was this kind of thing. My life was compartmentalized, okay? Work hard, you study hard, and then drink. But every time I drank, I had given myself permission to get drunk. And, you know, the alcoholic language, it was never in English. You know, I was never saying, "Jay, you're going to get drunk tonight." You know, it was just always there. You know, if I gave myself permission to drink, I gave myself permission to get drunk. You know, the reality of it is, when I look back, I was never getting drunk like the rest of my friends were. I mean, they weren't getting drunk like me. Mine was out of control, and I was starting to become, you know, the punchline. And that was starting to happen. When I graduated from dental school, I went on into some postgraduate work. But I went out and got, I was married by then. I got married in my last year of dental school. I'm still married to the same woman. You know, God bless her. At this time, we had a group of friends, but something was happening. And what was happening is that we were raising families. Kids were going to soccer games. You know, we were building houses, belonging to a JC group, doing all these kind of things. And I started noticing that these people that I was drinking with, they weren't at all doing it like I was. They were starting, as a matter of fact, to start to kind of push away from me. And I would start to hear things like, why do you have to drink this much? Or I would start to hear little things like, you've got a reputation. I was starting to hear that kind of thing. I was steadily, and every time I drank, my drinking was that of being a blackout drinker. So that was a big part of it. I would go to social events, and the social events I would go to, and I'm not kidding you, social events where everybody was in coat and tie, and I'd get drunk. I wouldn't remember how I got home, and have to end up many times calling somebody up the next day, apologizing for what I said to him or what I had said to his wife, It was a lot of that, and more, what was happening was shame. You know, I would just get up the next day, and be ashamed, and that was the big part. That was really what was worrying me more than anything. But it wasn't worrying me enough because I couldn't stop. What I had become was that mythological creature that we call a functional alcoholic. And I heard a guy come to our group and say, a functional alcoholic is nothing but a drunk with a job. And I never drank the night before I had to go in and see patients. I never did that. The only time I ever did anything like that was when I was in dental school. We had a rotation up in around up at UVA. And I remember going in there one morning with a hangover, and I said, I will never do this again. You know, I just had to give up. But that was that. So my life had become compartmentalized. I would not have any alcohol in me Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night. But on Thursday night, that's when it started. The reality of the issue is I was craving it by Tuesday. I mean, I was craving it, and because I liked the way that it made me feel. I've talked about my drinking, but I haven't said much about my thinking. What was really happening to me at this time is that I was a wreck. You know, the way that my work is. Is that I get my patients, my workload comes to me by the referral of other dentists. So I would go into the office constantly living in total fear. I don't ever remember a time when I look back when my whole life was governed by fear. And I'm talking about fear as, how am I going to be judged? What am I going to screw up today? How am I going to mess this patient up? How am I going to treat one of my employees wrong? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? I always had this. What we talk about, resentments. You know, I've always had that, particularly because I was comparing myself to other people. You know, other guys that I was working with, competitors, even my partner. You know, I was always doing that. The reality of it was just like the book. I lacked self-confidence. I lacked self-esteem. Heck, I mean, I got good grades. The state gave me a license. You know, I just couldn't understand why it was that I just never felt like I was good enough. At this time, I started turning to my to my physician, and he put me on some benzodiazepines. For those of y'all don't know what that is, Xanax, Valium. You know, Valium was my benzo of choice. And sometimes, and by the way, it's dry alcohol. And what was happening, I would go in the office and before I would start in the morning, I would literally be shaking, you know, just literally be shaking because of absolute fear. Once I started working, all that would go, but it was just a disaster. As I've heard people say before, I was literally coming out of my skin. To kind of fast forwarding here, what was starting to happen here is that my drinking at social events and social functions was just starting to get embarrassing. So what I would do is I would have a couple of drinks before I went, white knuckle it all through the party, and then when I came home, I would go ahead and just drink. And I remember many times watching the television and have to put one hand over one eye so that I could see the television set before I thought I fell asleep. I didn't fall asleep, you know. Back in 2003, I was part-time teaching over at NCB, and I had words with another one of the instructors over there, and it upset me. And I went to a function that night where it was all men. It was a fishing group, and it was all men, so it was, quote, okay to get drunk in front of these guys. And it was one of these nights where I got plastered, and two friends of mine took me home. I woke up in the bed the next day, and I don't remember how I got home or what happened. And you know, I had promised myself, I had known that I had a problem with my drinking. You know, I knew that it was a problem. I had done what all of us do. I had promised myself several times that I was gonna stop. You know, and that promise would last probably until that Thursday night, but I was just dying until then. But this time I kept the promise somewhat. I decided to call a psychologist who referred me to another psychologist and met with this guy, and he was salt of the earth. And this was back in 2003. A super nice guy. But at the end of one session, you know, and I expected the guy to kind of baby talk me, I guess. You know, I don't know what. I thought maybe he's going to pull some magic dust out and sprinkle it on me and cure me or something like that. But at the end of the session, he goes, "Your drinking is a pattern of an alcoholic." He says, "You will never be able to drink normally again. Don't ever even think that you will be able to." He said, "We're going to work together for a few months." And I'd go in and see him every week for a few months. And then he said, "When you finished, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." And it's like the guy had hit me upside the head with a 2x4, you know, because then it was like somebody saying, "You've got cancer," you know. And I've never had cancer, so forgive me if I'm making a bad comparison here. But what he was telling me, there was a finality to it. I mean, this is the real deal, guy. You know, you need to heed this warning. So I worked with this guy, and at the end of those months and everything like that, I hadn't drank anything. He said, "You know what you got to do?" He said, "You need to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting." So I found a meeting to go to, and I'm sure everybody here remembers what it's like when they went to their first AA meeting. You know, it was a church just like this. Walked in, a group of guys sitting there outside talking. I think they were talking about fixing cars or something like that. And I said, I walked up to him. I was like having a, you know, dog with a tail between my legs. And I said, "What is this place?" And he goes, "It's where people come when they have drinking problems." So, but it was a discussion group, and we sat in a big circle, and we talked about, they would bring something up, and we talked about, you know, is there any issues this week that anybody would like to share? They would share their issues, and it would always end up with, you know, "I couldn't do this if it wasn't for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous." I held these people in awe because these people had good long-term sobriety. but I don't ever remember, and it probably was, I wasn't a good listener, okay? I don't ever remember sponsorship. I don't ever remember home group, unity, service. I don't ever remember any of those kinds of things. But I don't ever remember inquiring either, you know. So I've had, you know, we do some of the service work and everything like that we do. I've heard people come into our group, and they'll say, I tried AA before, but it didn't take. Well, you know, I didn't take to it, you know, and that's the way it was. After about a year in there, I hadn't drank a drop, and I thought I had all the answers. And I remember talking to somebody, and I think the scal broke somebody's anonymity, and that looked as good an excuse as any to stop coming. So I missed the next meeting. Missing that meeting made it easy to miss the next meeting. That made it easier to miss the next, you know, just went like that. About, you all know where the story's going. About the next month or so, 2 months, I was with a buddy of mine who is not an alcoholic. He said, you know, you haven't drank for a year. You probably can drink if you just do it in moderation. He would say, do it in moderation. And drank one beer, you know, and nothing happened. But it was just like quitting those meetings, you know. The next one made it easy. And I remember I would tell myself, I would like set myself little roadblocks. If I get drunk again, then I'm going to make myself go back to AA meetings. You know, it was like these promises that I would make to myself, you know. But I didn't keep those promises either. For the next 5 years, I was drinking just like I was before, if not worse. And I knew it was getting worse. That was the problem. And at that particular point, I had gone back to being a home alone drinker. You know, again, my life was a total wreck. At the end of each week, I was doing the same thing. Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. And talk about if I drank, I gave myself permission to get drunk. When I do work on my patients, I always call them at the end of the evening to make sure everything's going okay. And on Friday, on Thursday night or Friday night, I always make sure I call them, because I wouldn't want them calling me after I'd had a few drinks of me. So, you know, that's the way it had gone. But my life was absolutely miserable. And back in 2009, I think I was at the Greek festival in Richmond. Went to a friend of mine's party with my wife, and last thing I can remember was sitting at his kitchen table, drinking some wine. The next morning, I woke up in my bed. Don't remember getting home from Richmond. I lived down in Colonial Heights, and I had an unexplained busted finger. Okay. Next day, my wife explained to me that when I was putting the dog out, he had to get rid of me. He didn't want to have anything to do with this drunk either. So, at that particular time, I had had enough. You know, I'd had enough. I knew what had started to dawn on me was two things I was afraid of, and the main thing was that I was just going to keep drinking to the point that I just didn't give a darn, you know, that I just wouldn't care. And I knew, at this point, I always cared. At least I had shame. And I was afraid that I was going to wake up one morning and just say, oh, the heck with it. You know, I knew that if I reached that point right there, that I was going to drink until I died. You know, I just knew that's the way it was going, because I couldn't see it going in another good direction. So, and I knew there was no treatment that could help me. I knew what treatment did, but I knew that treatment wasn't going to help me. You know, I wasn't in an alcoholic, so to speak, fog at that time. I knew that when I was Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wasn't doing it right. I wasn't doing what these other people were doing. I didn't have that same degree of sobriety that they had, and I knew when I was in there, I wasn't drinking. So, pulled out the where and when that we have in Richmond, pulled out the where and when, and I started going to this meeting that happened to be that happened to work out well with my work schedule. Again, this was maybe the third time the hand of God reached out to me. You know, I don't suggest picking out a home group because of convenience. Okay, this one happened to be convenience my work time. I walked into this home group, and to be honest with you, the first thing I liked about it, you've been to our home group before. The first thing I liked about it was the lighting, the lighting in the room. You know, maybe I can come in here and nobody will know me. You know, but it was, you know, it was a it was just the same kind of story. Our meeting starts at 7 o'clock. I'd get in there at 5 minutes to seven, leave at five minutes after eight. But slowly but surely, I was getting comfortable with these people. You know, I was getting real comfortable with them. If you've seen some of those guys in my home group, if you can be comfortable with those guys, you know, that's a quantum leap. Finally, I, you know, and this was after a few months, I got the gumption to go up to somebody that looked like he was enjoying his sobriety. And I asked him, can you be my sponsor? And he said, yes, but he said, it's a basic stuff. He said, call me every day. You know, just pick up the phone every day. And what I want you to do is to sit down, and every time that you got drunk, I want you to write down what happened and how you felt afterwards. You know, and I was 55 years old then. I said, man, I wish I had done this earlier in life. I mean, I wrote pages and pages. But what I actually was doing was a first step. You know, that is exactly what I was doing was a first step. Now, it's a difference between, you know, admitting we were powerless over alcohol. I could say it a million times, but if I didn't understand it, and finally after being beat down by alcohol for so long, you know, for so long, and realizing that I can never take another drink normally again, you know, That's when it truly sank in. So we did that. We started kind of going through the 12 steps. And, you know, I never was one that stopped. I grew up in a family where we went to church. I never stopped believing in God, you know. I turned my back on Him, you know. I put Him up on the shelf for a while. And it seemed like to me the only time I ever turned to Him was when I was in trouble. Or when it suited my designs. I was somewhere between belief and agnosticism. And once we got through that first part where I had to put God or God of my understanding, and that's one of the things I liked the most when I came into AA is that thing back here that says a God of our understanding. Nobody ever gave me that freedom before. You know, y'all gave me that freedom here. But you know, once we got over that part, and I was able to kind of keep Him in the center of things, then things started to work a little bit better. And that's a work in process. And then we did the fourth step just like the book tells you to. I sat down on paper, and we wrote out everything. And, you know, Bill talks about this psychic change, and my sponsor's sponsor one time, I remember hearing him speak, probably one of the correction things that we went to. He says, if you go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll come out the other end a different person. And that is the honest to gosh truth. That started happening at the fourth step for me. And the fourth step is the one that I can really remember, because it was the first time that I was ever able to really understand that all of my problems, almost all the problems in my life, were of my own making. Now, I may not have caused them, I may not have been at fault, but I may have put myself at the wrong party. I may have put myself behind the wheel at the wrong time. I may have interpreted a situation wrong. I may have reacted to it wrong. The problem is my thinking was all off. You know, I could take a bad situation and make it worse with my thinking. I was having I was I was compounding bad thoughts with more bad thoughts and believing every single one of them. And one thing the fourth step has done for me, and other aspects of the 12 steps, is that it made me know when that voice is in my head, you know, when I've got those bad thoughts. And I can sit back and say, there you go again. You know, and that's helped me a whole lot. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's perfect. You know, I still have those. I still have resentments, but now I know how to recognize them. And when they come up, I can stop them. We went on to that, and the amends process is ongoing. I mean, I had to look back, and I have never had any difficulty telling somebody I was sorry, or admitting I was wrong about something. But I stepped on people, I used people, I abused people, and I bullied people, particularly those that were weaker than I was. Those people that worked for me, you know. I have treated people that have worked for me in the past real, real rough. Now I've gone back and made amends and apologies and paid back people when I could. My family is the roughest amends, I'll tell you that. Because I was able to compartmentalize my drinking, they never really saw me, and a paycheck always came home. They never saw me as an alcoholic that you visualize, you know. They just knew me as a jerk, not an alcoholic. So myself and my sponsor, we talk about a living amends, and that's got to be ongoing all the time. You know, that's got to be ongoing all the time, and that's that classic one day at a time type of thing. The beauty part about as we work through these steps, you know, we repeat them. You know, it tells us to do the fourth step. The tenth step tells us to do the fourth step again, and the 11th step, you know, tells me to keep God in my, you know, keep God right in the center. And talk to him as often as I can. That's been the beauty part to me of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into this because I was dying. I knew that I was. Ours is in a. We've got a saying in our group. Ours is in a church basement. Okay, and we say people don't come into church basements when they're on a winning streak. But I didn't expect to get God back. You know, I didn't expect the spiritual journey, and it's that's something you guys never advertised. I'm very grateful for that aspect of it. But at the end of the 12 steps, my sponsor didn't say, you know, you need to take a break. You know, you need to relax. You've been through these 12 steps. You know, just kind of take it easy for a while. He said, you've got the ability to stay sober one day at a time. He said, now you need to get out there and start sharing how you have done it. You know, I said, I don't have the kind of sobriety. At that time, I think he had 15, 16, 17 years of sobriety. I said, I can't do this like you. He said, I don't want to hear it. Don't want to hear it. You know, just get out there and do it. I'm not going to tell you that first year of sobriety was easy. I have, you know, my sponsor had a great sponsor who probably had a great sponsor, and for that I am very lucky. But I debated him, you know, I fought with him, I questioned him, and not one time in that whole year, you know, did he ever tell me anything wrong? You know, he told me stuff I didn't want to hear. He told me stuff I needed to hear. You know, at that particular time, at about 6 months into my sobriety, and I'm sharing this part because this is you know, one everybody knows about me back in my home group. About 6 months into my sobriety, I was still taking the benzodiazepines, and I was doing that. I thought it was okay because I was doing it under the auspices of my physician. Okay. Well, my sponsor's a physician too, and I admitted this to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, "You need to pick up another white chip when you come to the meeting on 6 months into sobriety." He says, "You need to pick up another white chip when you come to the meeting. He said, and he goes, and if you ever need me here, he said, if you ever need me here, I'm always here for you. And what he basically was doing, he was throwing me off the bus, but at the same time he was reaching on the hand to pull me back on the bus. And I'll never forget that. You know, I mean, that aspect of it meant a whole lot to me. And I can remember I called him at the end of that week, and I thought for, I mean, it was just, I was chewing on the inside. But I called him back at the end of the week, and we talked and everything like that. And the reason I made that call back was because I know that this is where I have to be if I'm going to stay sober. And like I said, that man never told me anything wrong. And, you know, a lot of time has passed. Through that. What it's like today, my practice is thriving. I just ended up buying out my a partner, took on another associate. My staff is one of the most loyal staffs I've ever had. But it's kind of funny. They say, I don't know what's happened to you over the last few years, but we enjoy it so much. What's happened is this, and I just over a number of years I bought out of practice during a very rough recession. And I don't think I could have gone through that pressure if it hadn't been for this program, and the little promises that we read, they all came true for me. You know, we'll have staff meetings, and there's not a whole lot of difference between the way we run my staff meetings and the way we run an AA business meeting. You know, I just let, you know, it's not 100% democracy, but I let the the more I delegate out to them, the more they hear. You know, the more input they have, the more they enjoy it. Family's good. You know, still married, haven't lost home, haven't lost, but still, that's always a challenge. I'm not gonna kid you on that. My wife, you know, she comes to some meetings, but she does not beat down the Al-Anon door the way I would like for her to do it, but she's accepted the fact that this is what I'm doing. You know, I've got to do this. I enjoy it. It's a part of me now. Every description of the alcoholic in our big book is, you know, that's my description. I fit every one of them to a T. It's bizarre. When I talk about my sponsor, we got different professions and everything like that, but he knew me as if he was reading a book, because the same pattern, and that's just the way it was. The third leg of the stool, and we talk about, you know, work, family, and AA. I enjoy the heck out of AA. We are like y'all's group. We do a lot of service, and I dug my heels in. I said, I don't have time for all this service, but once you get into the service, there's no turning back from it. We do just like you guys do. We have a corrections group in a state facility, and we go in there. Like last week, we were all in there. It was three of us from the home group, but ten offenders in there. You know, one guy in there's got about 30 years of sobriety and from AA in another facility, and I go in there, and it's no difference between that AA meeting and any other AA meeting, sometimes even better. You know, it's the same thing. Topic meeting, we sit back and let them run the meeting. And it's been just, you know, our corrections committee chairman, he's, you know, Kent, he goes, yeah, I think you'll get something out of it. I've gotten a lot out of it. Watching these guys develop this home group out of nothing was just a very rewarding thing to me. And it's an hour ride out there, but I ride out there with another home group member, and it's always a meeting going to the meeting. We work, you know, work in the treatment facilities just like you guys do. But the neatest thing is to sponsor other people, and I just really enjoyed that more than anything. And I was the same way, I guess, when I came in, is to watch a man that's broken down from alcohol, and just work with him through those 12 steps, and just watch this person come back to life. You know, it's a wonderful thing. You know, in my practice, I might save a tooth. you know, there's a chance we may save somebody's life here. You know, and that never escapes me, you know. But in closing here, I want to thank you all for letting me come down and speak tonight. But like I said, you know, the most wonderful thing that about AA to me is it not only did it help me with my initial problem, that of drinking, but I never ever expected to bring God and this spiritual thing back in my life. So thank you all for letting me share. Appreciate it.